was, I think in chapter two, I talked to exactly, I guess that's why the conversation, right? Exactly about this question. And one of the things I was trying to underscore was that that the Rav's perspective on, you know, finding the Rabbonu Shalom in you know, in the world, in creation, is much more expansive than is typically you know, experienced. Now, usually, talk about finding Kadosh Baruch Hu in the world, so you're talking very specifically about nature, right, and about the kind of the, you know, the argument from design. If you're talking about arguments, you know, for the existence of God, if you're talking about just being inspired, let's say, you know, to greater faith. So, you know, there doesn't have to be the design as a compelling evidence of existence, but design is something which, you know, reflects, you know, an ongoing, like, inspiration of the world. So that's really the, we call it HaShemayim Mesafrit Kavod Kel Masi Adam Magid Arakia motif, and that's very typical in, you know, in Jewish thinking. You know, we find it in many, many, you know, Jewish philosophic works. But the four here, which are a little hard to pin down, as say, really, again, reflect that the Rav really has a much broader kind of agenda in these things. And interesting, because for somebody who is so halachic, you know, in his orientation, and philosophical, both, so, you know, you would have thought that, like, the categories would be much more rigid, you know, and much more mutually exclusive. You know, and they're not. Because even this understanding, like, he has four... First of all, it's an interesting chapter. And we already mentioned Mashcheni Acharecha Narutza is the subtext. That's just an amazing pasuk. Right, the Rav doesn't get credit for that. Shlomo Melech does. But... like Mashcheni and Acharecha Narutza, I think it's something that the Rav highlights right away, you know, kind of puts its finger on, you know, the relationship between, you know, choice and freedom. And, you know, the dialectic in Yahadus, you know, they're both, I think I said last time also, 2 weeks ago, you know, Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha Vin Hashuva, we have different psukim that, you know, connect us, Abba, Letaher, Messiah, so, you know, we have the opposite, you know, expressions of this, but they're two sides of the same coin. Sometimes man takes the initiative, you know, and then the Rabban Shalom kind of pushes the process, you know, forward. Sometimes it's the opposite. It's, you know, the initiative is from the divine, you know, direction, and then it's man's obligation to run with it. That's, you know, the Mashcheni Acharecha, literally, you know, Acharecha, you know, Narutza. So it's this idea of, you know, on the one hand, know, responding, and on the other hand, taking the initiative, is like a very important dialectic. So this little chapter, you'll see that the categories themselves overlap a lot. They're complex and they overlap. And that's because the Rav's a complicated halachic and philosophical thinker. And once again, a theme that we've been pursuing throughout, he just believes that the religious experience is very complex, that there are different components of it, and they're interaction of the different components is also complicated. Again, the opposite of the soundbite, you know, or the, you know, just pure behaviorist kind of approach. It's trying to examine, like, you know, what are the different overlapping ways in which being, you know, a commanded creature who isn't an automaton robot, but, you know, is supposed to carve for himself his own destiny, you know, with implies a certain initiative and freedom, but at the same time is defined by his religious commitment. So, like, how does that really work? So the idea that there would be, you know, stops and starts, which is what this whole, you know, piece is about, right? And, you know, missed opportunities and then, you know, new opportunities, you know, but some of the disappointments of the previous, you know, kind of moving you in this process, but a very, very complex process and therefore very complex, you know, components in all the steps of the process really makes a lot of sense when you consider what it is that's at stake. Right, this chapter, in a way, how does creation search for its creator, is another way of saying, is another way of reiterating the title of the piece, which is Ubikashta Misham, right? Es Hashem Elokecha. How do you seek, you know, the Ribon Shalom? So the four realms, as I say, are not what you would have expected them to be at all. They're far more wide-ranging, and each one is far more complex and overlapping than you would have expected. The first is the cosmic drama. That's the easy one. That's Hashemayim Misaprim Kavod Kel. And then later in the same page, on the same paragraph, it's clear what that is, you know, intended to mean. The lawfulness of the effect. The first cause, the telos, the continuity of causal order, as well as ruptures within it. But the others are just, you know, fascinating. So the depths of spiritual existence, which we talked about before a little bit in, you know, in psychology, the system of a priori concepts, particularly religious facticity and transcendental experience. So what do these things even mean? So the second one is fascinating. The complex of moral will, which is manifested paradoxically in the joint consciousness of absolute freedom and total obligation, of the call of conscience and the despondency of the sinning soul. The aesthetic experience intertwined with the vision of transfinite sublimity. Right, the order of cultural values, metaphysical yearning, essence and process of cognition, and that's a lot of things. But let's zero in on the main one, which I think is the complex of moral will, paradoxically manifested in joint consciousness of absolute freedom and total obligation. So I say this is really the Mashkeni Acharecha Narutza, you know, aspect of it. It's the combination, in my opinion, of Bechira Chavshis. This is not in my opinion, that's really what it is, but in terms of halachic institutions, Bechira Chavshis on the one hand, and Godol Mitzvah V'Yoseh. So in terms of Bechira Chavshis, again, the Rambam puts a particularly high premium on this. I think we already mentioned it's the kind of Briach HaTichon of Hilchos Tshuva, which is 10, you know, chapters, and this is Karakei. And it's clear that it's there for the same reason that Perigyud is there. Probably could have done without Perikei and Perigyud if you were just interested in codifying, you know, the laws of Tshuva. But because Tshuva is the culminating chapter of Sefer Mada, and in itself is an avoda, Hashem, so, you know, the Bechira part and the Abba part, you know, are critical because they kind of uplift, if you will, like the technical laws of Tshuva and establish that they really are like a process of, just like Tefillah is a process, the Talmud Torah is a process of Avodas Hashem, right? And Yisodei HaTorah is about, you know, the main principles of Yahadus, and Avodah Zarah is the, you know, the opposite of that, which you're not supposed to believe, and so on. So, you know, Hilchos Tshuva is also, it's about a methodology of Avodas Hashem, and therefore the Bechira piece is particularly crucial. Again, not only because, as the Rambam explains and others all explain, the elemental point of it, which is there's no Skar Ba'onesh, right, unless there is Bechira Chavshis. You know, that's why, you know, the dilemma of foreknowledge and freedom of will really plagued, you know, it plagued some people as a conundrum, like an intellectual or philosophical, you know, conundrum. You know, but for people, again, who care about it, you know, for whom their religion, their commitment to religion is what defines their life, so it's like a terrible dilemma, you know, to figure out the relationship between divine foreknowledge and free will. And the Rambam took several cracks at it. You know, the Rambam was critical of the Rambam. You know, he made the comment, you know, that, you know, if this is the best that he could do, you know, then, you know, maybe, you know, maybe he shouldn't have bothered. That's his comment in Hilchos Tshuva. You know, kol tzavui, you know, a rishus, you know, nitna. But, you know, the Rambam, you know, multiple efforts, you know, to crack this problem, and then Avraham Avinu basically says that divine knowledge is different than human knowledge, and therefore not subject to the same rules, which is very consistent with what he says about certain other things, you know, about negative, what we call negative theology issues. But the multiple attempts is because it isn't just to solve a particular problem. You know, Bechira, and, you know, embracing the system, the Akarecha Narutza, let's say, that results from the Mashkeni, is really a critical part of what is. Otherwise, you know, if we're doing this against our wills, just to, you know, rack up credits, then it's a whole different experience. And if the point is to give our lives meaning, develop a kesher and a bond, you know, with the Ribbono Shel Olam, then of course it has to be, you know, out of a sense of Bechira. At the same time, Gadol Mitzuva Viosa Mimishena Mitzuva Viosa. So again, it's interesting that the Bali Tosis in Kiddushin suggests that you know, has a psychological, you know, component. Because what it really means is that, you know, people, this is, you know, certainly true, that people are more, you know, reluctant, you know, to do things that they're obligated to do. You know, somebody, you know, volunteers, if you choose to do it, you're more enthusiastic. And even the psychology of doing something, you know, as an act of volition itself, you know, is a very heady, you know, kind of process. Whereas, you know, when somebody imposes on you with an externally motivated, you know, just it's less attractive, you know, and there are more reasons, you know, that you are reluctant, procrastinate, etc. So that's how the Bali Tosfos explain Gadol Mitzuva Viosa Mimishena Mitzuva Viosa. And, you know, contrary to, you know, popular thinking, you know, actually it's more difficult, you know, to do things that are, you know, obligatory. But I think that not all Rishonim agree with that view. And I think there's a lot of evidence that the idea of tzivui has to do with the quality of what it is that you're doing. It's ain't a dome. Again, if you're just, you know, behaving behavioristically, to use the terms that we were talking about before, then you know, it wouldn't matter one way or another. But if the point is to develop again this Baal Ratzon Kadosh Baruch Hu Zakas Yisrael Afikachir B'Lev Torah Mitzvos, then the fact that, you know, there's a divine imprimatur, and that, you know, there's even an obligation that it's part of Kabbalah Sol Mitzvos and Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shemayim, you know, that kind of elevates the act as an avoda, separate from the psychology. It's a very interesting phenomenon. This thing with the Rav again, but just on this point, like in the world, phenomenologically in the world of halacha, you know, you can sometimes experience a situation where mitzara gavra, will say, something is a rishus, and mitzara cheftza it's a chova, or the opposite, and that's a good way to test some of these cases. Sometimes you'll have an obligation to do something, but the cheftza shel mitzvah is a cheftza shel rishus. For example, where you have the issue, osik mitzvah patur min mitzvah. Right. So what impact does that have on the mitzvah that you're potter for? The Ritva in Sukkah says that it turns the other mitzvah into rishus. Therefore, you don't even have the right, you know, to do it. Or mitzvah seishas man grama nashim pturos. Right. So what is the status of that particular mitzvah? Tfilas arvis rishus. Right. So in all those cases, there are interesting discussions on two different levels. Are we talking about something that is what I was saying before, a cheftza shel mitzvah schova, but it's you have the right to do it or not to do it, right? Or the opposite. Maybe in some cases you're even obligated to do it, but what we're saying is this, as a category, it's not a mitzvah schova. Right? In all these cases, osek mitzvah, mitzvah seishma grama could have to do with the bracha. What's the bracha on? Right? Osek mitzvah, as I say, what choices you have. What if you do the, you know, the other one that you're potter on? Tzilas arvus rishus. Whole discussion about tashlumin. Right? Can missing arvus, if it's only rishus, trigger a chiyuv tashlumin? What about the ta'us? You know, you leave out yalo v'yavo. Well, Rishonim discuss these questions, Bali Tosas, the Rif, the Rambam, the Rajba. So we find in these and in other, you know, cases, very interesting discussions about Rishus doesn't have to mean both, and Chova doesn't have to mean both. But I think what's significant about it is, you know, the psychological part, you know, is all connected to the Gavra. In other words, do you have a choice in doing what you're doing or not? But the idea of being a mitzuveh, in terms of the quality of your avodas Hashem, has to do with both of these elements in different ways. Maybe with the chavtza shel mitzvah and with the maisa mitzvah. But it's a way kind of integrating, you know, these two ideas, the idea of choice and the idea of total obligation, you know, which really come together. So that's the second category that he's describing. And this really is, you know, getting back to the first formulation of the depths of a person's spiritual existence. For the Rav, depths of spiritual existence here is not spirituality as we, you know, sometimes designate it. Because I think this is not about spirituality. It's about the dilemma, or not the dilemma, it's about the challenge you know, that is encountered by a religious person as he, you know, seeks this balance, you know, between controlling his own destiny, feeling that what he's doing, you know, volitionally on the one hand, and at the same time, the fact that he's not simulating or formulating his own religion. Because the whole idea of Torah mitzvos as categories is the fact that they are, you know, stamped with the imprimatur, the divine imprimatur. So that's the idea of mashcheni acharecha narutza, of having, you know, freedom and having total sense of obligation at the same time. That's the call of conscience, right, where you're responding, you know, again, as an act of will, and the despondency of the sinning soul, meaning that objectively when a person's involved in chet, you know, it leaves a stain on his neshama, whatever that means. You know, I don't mean metaphysically necessarily, or maybe also metaphysically, but you know, that he's lost something. The aesthetic experience, his personal experience, intertwined with the vision of transfinite sublimity, you know, the thing that's, you know, that's, I guess, you know, more objective, more, I guess, ontic than existential, if you will. So that's the second category. The third category is what he calls the pinnacle of the system of pure concepts of understanding, the a priori concept of deity distinct from any psychophysical experience, as the essential crowning jewel of being. So this is, I think, an overlap from the previous one. This is the idea of, again, the Rav is known as, in some of his works, like Only Man of Faith, and, you know, some of the other essays, you know, as being very existentially oriented. Right? The existential meaning, for lack of a better explanation, I guess the more experiential or subjective, you know, the way that you experience things, meaning experiential. But certainly Ish Halacha and parts of Ubikashta Misham are much more ontological. Ontological having to do with, like, objective being, almost like a Platonic form, you know, idea. So here the Rav's talking about the ability to appreciate, right, the pure, I'm adding the word, Platonic concept of the deity. Right, to appreciate, in other words, the Rabbonu Shalom, separate from your experience, you know, of him or with him, just to appreciate you know, what the concept of transcendence, if you will, or ontic, you know, existence, separate from the existential and the personal and the experience. The essential crown jewel of being, ontic, is, that's why I use that term. No, he's not using it here. And then the fourth is really the religious experience itself. The sense of absolute dependence, frustrated yearning, pulsating in man's spirit, right? The ecstasy of the mystical masters, the intuition of a supersensible realm, and the like. So this, I think, is, you know, the idea of, again, once you, you know, have kind of given separate emphasis to the, you know, to the concept of the Rabboni Shalom, or the Rabboni Shalom and his, I guess, transcendence, so then the fourth one is the Rabboni Shalom in what we call his, the more existential one, the way that it affects your own existence. And here, of course, you have, again, this, like, tremendous range, like, of emotions. Like, you have the dependence part and the ecstasy part, which, again, is very much what Shir HaShirim, you know, is really all about. And it's the highs and lows of man, who on the one hand has the capacity and the interest in seeking, you know, transcendence and seeking the Rabboni Shalom, and that's very heady. That's the ecstatic, you know, majestic part. But at the same time, who's kind of bound to fail because there's a certain level of unattainability or inaccessibility. But then you get this oscillation back and forth, and that's part of what the religious experience is as well. The next couple of pages are just interesting. I don't think the tochen really adds so much to, you know, to these four methods, let's say, of discovering the Rabboni Shel Olam, but I think that they represent, or they reflect, again, the Rav's range. In it, he uses Kabbalistic terms, and, you know, he very, you know, with great ease, you know, transitions between, you know, concepts of Kabbalah, which he draws, interestingly enough, both from the Tanya and from Nefesh HaChayim. The truth is that the Tanya, as I can talk about another time, is, you know, when we see Tanya today, you know, we have a different response. At least I do. But in its time, you know, Lubavitch was one of the most litvisha, if you will, you know, Hasidus. Okay, in other words, in terms of being ground in Talmud Torah and being very, very mainstream in its thinking. So the overlap, you know, between the Tanya and the Nefesh HaChayim in this particular issue, but that, again, this is kind of the Rav's range, but also his ability to mobilize, like, a wide range, what some people would think would be a mutually exclusive range, you know, types of sources, you know, to illustrate, you know, the point that he's trying to make. So, like, the first one is, you know, there's no hidden corner of the natural or the natural or spiritual worlds, meant conscious leitatar de panui minei, but not for the Rabboni Shalom. He means, again, it's like a play on leitatar de panui minei, which is a theological statement about the omnipresence of the Rabboni Shalom in the world, and instead he's using it as the omnipresence of opportunities, right, to be megala personally, or to do this, you know, bikashta misham, process, you know, to try to scrutinize, you know, the world. There's no hidden corner, natural, spiritual, in which man's consciousness, pining for its divine beloved, does not peer into and scrutinize. Okay, so it's use of language that usually is devoted to one thing, right? Investigating buds of transcendence that appear so often in the spiritual desert. The search is not the romantic yearning, this is also very important, of fugitives from the monotonous secularism of the everyday. A lot of mysticism, especially if you look at, you know, again, we were talking about, you know, popular religion and behaviorism before. So there's something called popular mysticism, too. When somebody wrote a, you know, like, there are all these pop Kabbalah books now, and Kabbalah centers, and very strange, you know, phenomena. a lot of it is the romantic, or maybe not even romantic, yearning of fugitives from the monotonous secularism of the everyday. Now, the truth is that there is something in mysticism generally which is about, you know, fleeing monotonous, mundane, everyday life. But it's even more particularly the case, I say, some of the phenomena that we encounter today. But again, the Rav is kind of like taking mysticism, putting a philosophical and halachic, you know, spin on it, so that it's not, you know, a refuge from daily life. Rather, it's the general culture consciousness, you know, man longing to escape from the straits of limited, bounded, contingent world, again, and go out into the limitless, independent, wide-open spaces. It's an act of self-transcendence. In other words, instead of being an escapism, you know, from the dull and the mundane, you know, he's turning it into, again, a process of self-transcendence, of elevating yourself. It's not negatively motivated, it's motivated by Ubikashti Misham Hashem, Es Hashem Elokecha. And then you get this very interesting range of sources or of references. The question whether the deity's connection with the world is transcendent or immanent is irrelevant. This is also very important. Because, again, the focus here is not on objectively the nature of the Rabbonu Sholem and the nature, in the nature of Avodas Hashem, mitzad, to use like maral type terminology, you know, mitzad the bore. It's really to try to define what man, you know, is supposed to focus on as he pursues, right, this act of self-transcendence, in other words, upgrading his own spiritual life and its meaning and significance. And in that context, he says, and I think it's very interesting, so of course it's true, but that, so therefore divine transcend the degree of, or the deity's connection with the world, transcendent, imminent, it's irrelevant. Because both are true, and either way, it's not the objective question which we're talking about, it's this avodas Hashem of the individual. Man sometimes attempts to find God within reality, sometimes beyond it. There are many facets to man's awareness of God, replete with the absolute and eternal, yet reverberates within the contingent temporal creature. Right? Occasional notes of the old new song, I like that phrase, I guess that's not interesting formulation. The old new song that bursts forth from without as well as from within. And that's when he uses the Tanya and Reb Chaim Mivolozhin, the Kabbalistic phrase, I don't have the Hebrew for today, but fills and surrounds all the world. The mystical master is justly taught the deity separates itself from the existence, and is also the Shekhinah is in the existence. There's Malchus, right, and there is Shekhinah. So again, the Rav does this very often and very effectively. You know, he takes Kabbalistic ideas that really have a much more technical meaning, and he kind of uses them as medrash, you know, and some combination of medrash and philosophy to like identify themes that are much more accessible. So you have that on this page, and then on the next page, so we'll just get by for next time. The Kabbalist, the internal Jewish, you know, mystical references, seeking God through an external and internal world, not a theological issue of interest only to scholars of religion. Again, that would be the objective, you know, trying to define the Rabbonu Shalom, right, or some rarefied exercise. But it's a fundamental problem that arose at the dawn of humanity, to show that it's endemic, you know, to man's search for a meaning. It rose at the dawn of human culture, from the time of Greek philosophers, the masters of modern philosophy, different forms, in accordance with the historical and cultural peculiarities of each epoch. Again, important, obvious things, but important formulations, the idea that every generation has its own vocabulary, you know, particular ways of looking at things that can be, you know, mobilized, you know, for this. And that's what he does. That's what he did. That's what he did with Neo-Kantian philosophy, and that's what he, you know, he does with other things. Even mathematics do not deny this fact. Divine mystery remains in place even in the field of scientific knowledge. Scientific knowledge cannot transcend its own limits. Science admits the presence of irrational elements in any worldview, doesn't deny the right of others to investigate it, because he's not dismissive of, you know, the contrary. We, In other contexts, he compares, you know, Brisker Lumbus to, you know, physics and math. So obviously his high opinion of it, right? But the point is that that's the, you know, formulation, and that's the a priori aspect of it. But what is the irrationality? You know, it's the beyond that. It doesn't mean irrational, I mean non-rational, hovering over the pure scientific conception. The answer is that it's in the realm of the qualitative and the sensory. Modern physics, you know, is symbolic, but it can't provide satisfactory explanations. We want to penetrate the innerness and the essence of being, or the qualitative realities we experience. That's where you need religion, right? Aristotelian physics, you know, attempts to explain, this will stop, reality through its true essence and experiential qualities, but it failed and misled people for many centuries because it led them to believe sincerely that intellectual enlightenment could be effective in describing qualitative being. Both classical and modern physics have abandoned this daring enterprise. Creators of modern science are aware of the irrational character of the world. The deeper truth revealed to them, that they have to give up vain attempts of ancients to understand the essence of phenomena through mathematical formulas, etc. That's what leads you back to religion and to Misora, you know, as seeking, like, a more effective path, I guess, to describe or to better integrate the qualitative aspects of life. So it's interesting, we'll talk maybe next time, that, you know, there's a great appreciation for mobilizing different techniques and different disciplines, and a recognition that every generation has, you know, its own vocabulary or effective vocabulary. And I want to talk a little bit about that next time, and then we'll move on to the next part of the process. Okay. Make sure you...